Blog Talk Radio.
Come on.
Good evening, everyone. This is Carl, and this is the ISF podcast. And thanks for coming in and listening to us. Remember that you can always catch us at the Deviant Legion page on Facebook and also at the Incredibly Strange Films. It's what's called the ISF podcast. And, of course, I have my co-host Rachel with me. Say hello, Rachel.
Hello, Rachel, and everybody else here today.
I knew that was happening. Anyway, but today we are very, very pleased to have author, film critic, and sports writer Danny Perry with us. Danny, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks so much. Great to be here. Hi, Rachel. How are you?
I'm good. How are you, Danny?
I'm good. I want to tell you that I prepared so much for this by being the first person ever to shave before a podcast. So,
Oh, good Lord.
Know, I recently showered before a podcast because I was so excited.
I do that after the podcast. After the podcast.
Oh,
yeah,
see, that's
a good
idea.
But, no, I did not shave before the podcast. I'm sorry.
Okay. Well, anyway, thanks, guys, for inviting me. Much appreciated.
Oh, well, thank you very much for coming, Danny. So before we get into film and of course, your series of books, the cult movie books, you also did a lot of baseball books. And just tell us a little bit about what you've done as far as, you know, working with Tim McCarver and all the books you've done. And there's one I'm going to particularly mention, which is the Ralph Kiner book. I grew up in Pittsburgh, so my dad would always tell me stories about Ralph Kiner. And I did read that book years ago.
Baseball
a little
forever.
Bit about baseball.
Yeah. Well, I started out as a just doing movie books, and in fact, I don't think I've done a movie book since about 1995. What happened is I burnt myself out doing movie books, just seeing trillions of movies and writing about them, and I kind of started repeating myself. And growing up, besides being a movie fan and a rock and roll fan, I was also an obsessive sports fan, particularly baseball. And I had a particular baseball player that I loved named Vic Power, and I wanted to meet him. So I'd become known in movie circles for my three cult movie books and cult movie stars, and I asked my editor, who was a good friend of mine, his name's Tim McGinnis, he's passed away, but I said, what if we do a book called Cult Baseball Players, where I assign articles to famous writers and famous other baseball players and famous sports writers, and they each write about particular ball players who they adored growing up or as young adults and who were a little quirky, but had cult followings, so including my favorite baseball player, Vic Power. And that's how I got into baseball writing. I called Vic Power up on the phone in Puerto Rico, said, in 1954, this is, by the way, 40 years later, this is in the mid-90s, I was a fan in 1954. He was the first baseball card I ever had. And I said, you know, you're my idol. I would like to interview you and do a book. And, you know, he was, what? He couldn't believe somebody, you know, adored him as much as I said I did. And this is many years later. He'd been retired now at that point for 30 years. And he said, sure, okay, I'll be in. You can come to Puerto Rico and interview me. So once I got his approval, I did the whole book, assigning other, you know, 40 or 50 or 60 other people to write articles. And I did my chapter on Vic Power, and my wife and I went to Puerto Rico, and we spent several days with Vic Power. And after that, I became a sports writer, basically. I've actually done more sports books And then I have movie books, even though I'm still, after all these years, much more known for my film books than my baseball books. And my Tim McCarver connection was, it actually started while I was writing movie books, because we were handled by the same agency. I was handled by the book editor at the agency, and Tim was working with I had that agent, and she became my agent. Tim worked with the head of the agency, Robert Rosen, and who was signed him things, and they learned what a big sports fan I was, and they put me together with Tim back in 1986, the year the Mets won the pennant and won the World Series. So it was kind of exciting. We did a radio show together in 1986. So that was my first entrance into sports writing. And then about in the mid-90s, when I did Cult Baseball Players, that started it. And I did a whole bunch of more baseball books, including and with Tim and I worked together for 30 years. We did radio, then a syndicated television show, the Tim McCarver Show, from 2000 to 2017, and I was the writer and the researcher and that. And Tim, for a long time, was the Mets announcer, as you probably know. And Ralph Kiner was another one. So I met Ralph Kiner, who was also handled by Robert L. Rosen Agency, and I met him doing another book, We Played the Game, and he got a book deal to do an autobiography, and I became the writer on that. So Ralph and I became really close friends, and I miss him to this day. And the great story, if you know, you said you read the book a long time ago, but the way that book begins in the intro is the first and second sentence. He says, when I was being scouted by various baseball teams, and I knew that I would sign a major league contract. This was around 1940, and he was like 18, and he said, I still didn't trust that, you know, I'd have a career in baseball, so I opened a bank account, and thinking that my baseball career would end quickly. Well, it didn't end until he passed away just a few years ago. His baseball career, from player to general manager in the minors to Mets broadcaster, just went the whole gamut, all those years, decades. So that's why we call the book, his autobiography, Baseball Forever.
Nice. Now, I grew up in Pittsburgh, and I'm a little younger than you, but I grew up with Clemente and Mazeroski, and my dad had the 1960 pennant record, and he would play for us and actually give us written tests. I'm not joking. Mm-hmm. So I was a Pittsburgh fan in the womb.
Let me interrupt you quickly, Carl. My favorite game of all time is the seventh game of the 1960 World Series, which
unreal.
Luckily our teacher in sixth grade in Levittown, Pennsylvania, and for some reason our teacher brought a TV in, and we watched the game, and Mazeroski, of course, hit the home run, and that was like the greatest moment in baseball history of all my viewing pleasures.
I agree. But one thing I did want to ask you, you know, what is it about baseball that makes it so wonderful? Now, there's a lot of answers to this, but to me, it's the perfect game. I mean, I love football. I love other sports. But to me, baseball is always a game. And I lived in Frederick, Maryland for a number of years. And we had a single-A ball club there. And I just loved going there and watching the game. It doesn't matter how good the players are, there's just something magical about that game.
Well, I think, You are younger than me, but when I was growing up in the 50s, it was still the point where baseball was America's game. And it had been like that the whole century, the whole part of the 20th century, and all the immigrants coming in, and the game that they all played was baseball. Basketball and football really didn't really attract many people because they knew they wouldn't be able to make a living of any kind playing professional basketball or playing professional baseball. So everybody, all the great players, all the white players and all the black players were all playing baseball. And you mentioned the word perfect, and it's such a strange thing about baseball. Who put the mound 60 feet, 6 inches away from home plate? Who made the base pass 90 feet long? You know, we're talking about perfection. You know, who thought of these things, and who devised all the pitches and all the equipment and all the rules? And it just there was something magical. There's still. You know, I played every sport, you know, sandlot every sport, and there's great moments making touchdowns and making baskets. But when you hit the ball exactly right, there's nothing like that. So I see the appeal of it all. You know, and Ralph Kiner, you know, he as a kid, he could hit the ball a long way, and his idol wasn't Red Grange. It was Babe Ruth. And everybody wanted to be Babe Ruth, you know, bigger than life figure. And I think it's still that way. I think especially with the pandemic stuff and all the stuff going on with football, with the head injuries and stuff, that a lot of parents will be reluctant to let their kids go into football. So the choices are basketball and baseball. More and more.
I do love the game, and certainly I really appreciate, you know, all that you've done to promote baseball over the years with your sports writing. But to be honest, that's not why you're on the podcast when we're doing an Incredibly Strange Films podcast. So tell us about how the cult movie books became, how that all worked out and how that started.
I'd actually done two books before I did these cult movie books. In case people don't know, I did one cult movies in 1981, and then cult movies 2 in 1983, and then 5 years later I did cult movies 3, and those are the only ones. I did a book I mentioned before, Cult Movie Stars, which was you know, a book on the side, you know, just about the actors themselves. But I did a book on animation with my brother Gerald Perry, who's become a documentarian, and I also did this, probably, which people don't realize because I'm known for my cult movie books, but my biggest seller ever was my first book. So everything was downhill after that. It was called Close Ups, the Movie Star Book, and where this young kid, me, I got 130 people to write chapters about individual movie stars, critics, but also directors and screenwriters and actors, and it was like a big, big seller, and it's kind of a book I'm very proud of, but people don't know. It had many, many printings, but that's a book from 1978, so people don't know about it. I completely understand, but it was successful. So because of its success, I could pitch another idea to publishing companies, and they'd be receptive to whatever I wanted to do. So what do I want to do is what I thought. And, I don't know how familiar you guys are with my work, but in the cult movie books, but there's a lot of variety in there. The big plus for me, and why I appeal to people coming from as a complete outsider, people have never heard of me, was that I loved all kinds of films, from, you know, from the horror films to classics like Citizen Kane. And so I could write about, you know, westerns and musicals and comedies. I saw them all. I wasn't a snobby guy who rejected science fiction films of the 50s. In fact, I devoured them. So I was somebody who had seen and enjoyed and could write about almost any kind of film. So I said to myself and to the editors I talked to, what about if I created a whole new genre of film, and that genre would be cult movies, and cult movies would include every other genre. So there'd be films coming, you know, westerns like Once Upon a Time in the West, and, you know, horror movies like I Walk with a Zombie, which was, I think, the sample chapter I did was I Walk with a Zombie, the Pal Luton film directed by Jacques Tourneur, and Singing in the Rain for musical, and Top Hat, and just films that people were obsessed with. And so that's what I came up with, and that's the genesis of it, how I got into writing a book about cult movies. So, you know, just the titles in my first cult movie book, you would have like Pink Flamingos and Johnny Guitar and, Conquer Worm, which is a little obscure, the Michael Reeves film with Vincent Price, Rock and Roll High School, and The Searchers, the John Ford movie. So there's a lot of different titles and a lot of different genres mixed together into one genre, and they all had one thing in common: they were cult movies.
Well, we'll ask a moment, you know, what is your definition of cult? But first, I want to kick it over to Rachel and see if she has a question for you. Rachel? Well,
yes,
I guess not.
Yes,
okay. Oh, there you are.
No,
you have a question for Danny?
I'm still here.
I have one question that my idiot fan base has been asking me, and this is going to sound so awful, but I'm sorry, I have to do it. So since you are a fan of the game baseball, and you also love cult movies.
Yes.
Okay. What are your feelings on the cult movie classic, Basketball?
Yeah, if you could see my thumb, it's pointed down. So. No, I saw it when it came out. I actually thought it might actually work because it was such an audacious title. No, I didn't like it. Does that person who called you, maybe they're still on the phone with you, do they remember the whole plot to Basketball? Because I don't,
yeah.
I admit.
Yeah, they do. Unfortunately, it's one of the movies that we own.
Oh, you own this. Oh, yeah.
One of the loyal following.
Yeah,
you fell
in the trap.
Well,
one of the things, I know you're going to ask me my definition of cult movies, but I always say that every horror movie and every science fiction movie has at least a small cult. But what I've discovered, you know, through letters from people is I think every movie ever made has a little cult to it. So the question is, you can have a little discussion on the side there, is are there other people you get together and talk to about Basketball, and you all say, oh, I like it too. It's really great. I'm glad you like it. Do you ever have that conversation, or are you too embarrassed?
Well, this isn't a show about me personally. This was just about your feelings on things.
You don't care for yourself, but.
I'm okay with it. I do admit that I laugh every time I watch it, but it's also not one of my favorite movies of all time. But
no.
Yeah, I promised actually more than one person that I was going to ask you that.
No,
so
I was.
Sorry.
I was.
Thank you.
No, I was ready for like Bull Durham or something like that, or, you know, the Major League, whatever, or my favorite baseball movie, Bang the Drum Slowly. So
absolutely. I'm trying
to
get John Hancock on
the show.
No, but tell your friend that next time it is on, I will see it again because that person likes it so much. Because that's what I like to do. And people, a lot of, you ask the definition of cult movies. A lot of it has to do with people talking to other people and saying, "You got to see this movie. You got to see this movie," because that's how all the cults start. And so when somebody's enthusiastic about a title, even if I saw it years ago and shrugged it off and immediately forgot the plot, if I didn't forget the title, then I do try to see them again. In fact, Carl, you know this, the thing that I've been posting, because I don't know, you didn't say that you were part of all these threads of mine, is that people are giving me recommending horror movie titles and science fiction titles, and I actually wrote down a lot of them because I, you know, never heard of them, or I saw them so many years ago I don't really remember what I felt.
That's the wonderful thing about film, and that's one of the things about our group, which is Incredibly Strange Films. We have over almost 300,000 people in that group. And so,
wow.
You know, there's a lot of repeats, but there's so much material out there that I've never even heard of. So it's like a buffet. Oh, I got to check that out. But the one thing I do want to say to you is you codified something for me many, many years ago when I first got the cult movies book in 1981. There was a film that I loved, which I said to people, "You got to watch this. You got to watch this. I don't care if you've seen all, you know, the Private Eye movies. You got to see this one." And people looked at me like I was nuts back in 1974 when I first saw it on HBO. But I kept talking about it, and then I saw your book, and that movie was in Cult Movies 1, and that was The Long Goodbye, which is still, to this day, my favorite film of all time for many, many reasons.
Well, you tell me, because this should be a conversation, why you like that movie so much. And of course, I like it so much, too. I actually have stories about it. But why do you think you responded as much as you did to that film?
Without a doubt. When I was I had some physical problems when I was younger. And so I was in braces and things like that. So I couldn't go out and play with the other kids. So what I did is I read. And I read two types of literature, basically, science fiction, like Ray Bradbury and that. And the other thing I read was Private Eye stuff, hard-boiled, Chandler, and so on and so forth. So I love the idea of wanting to be a private detective. But I couldn't,
wow.
You know, I mean, look at me, and I'm not Bogart. I'm not anybody like... And then I see this movie, and there's Elliot Gould. Smart ass, you know, but very underrated. People don't realize how smart he is. And he gets himself out of situations somehow, you know. And of course, everything about it, and I was an Altman fan beforehand, but the attitude... updating it to the 70s, being very satirical about that time. It just absolutely, but to be honest, the main reason is I saw L.A. Gould as Marlowe, and I said, that could be me, and particularly that opening sequence with the cat.
Well, I got to tell you, that's really interesting. Yeah, what people have different reasons for liking films and why a film will you'll say that this film is just for me, which a lot of cult movies are. It's just you really connect to it for a certain reason. And as you know, a cult film is a cult film because everybody, years after it was released, don't Everybody doesn't care about it. Everybody doesn't love it. Everybody doesn't appreciate it, and some people don't like it. And part of the reason Long Goodbye was a cult movie is that everybody did not like it. I loved it, so we agree on it. And one of the main reason people didn't like it is you mentioned one of them is it's updated and moved to Los Angeles of all places. In 70s Los Angeles, where they have girls doing yoga in the nude across the way from Chandler, and just neon lights everywhere, and everybody's a little spacey and crazy, and all of a sudden you move Philip Marlowe into this, and you make him Jewish, of all things, a Jewish actor playing Philip Marlowe. So we've had previous Marlowes, the Bogart and Dick Powell, and then you had Robert Mitchum, who I thought was a really good Philip Marlowe, and all of a sudden Elliot Gould, who had seen his better days, who was actually needed a good role to get back to being an A-list actor, and he had been in MASH, as you know, for Altman. So what you mentioned is about that film, which I really like, is if you watch the whole movie, you watch Marlowe just, you know, doing what Marlowe always does, is he investigates, he never stops, he just keeps going after the truth. And he's the one knight in shining armor, and everything else around him is usually, in the noir films, everything's black, and this everything was neon lit. But he just keeps going, and he gets pushed around by everybody, thrown in jail, beaten, just treated miserably, and there's these awful people around him and dangerous people around him. And then at the end, when he finds out that, I guess his name's Terry, played by Jim Ballen, his friend has betrayed his trust and he's the killer, he takes out his gun and just shoots him. Marlowe shoots his best friend. And we realize in that one moment, the one moment of violence by this Philip Marlowe, who's never hit anybody or done anything, that he was never out of his league this entire film, that he knew what he was doing. He was willing to take all the punishment, because at the end he was able to dole it out himself when he wanted to. And he just goes down the street dancing, and that's how the film ends.
Yeah. Now, and of course, a lot of people hated the fact that he shot Terry at the end of that, because that's not something Marlowe would do. But Leigh Brackett, who wrote the screenplay, had that in the screenplay, and decided that was how to end the film. And of course, film adaptations are never the novel, so you know, it's how you interpret it. But anyway.
Yeah. No, but I think it was a perfect ending. You know, at around that time I did I spent a couple of days with Elliot Gould doing interviewing him for some short-lived magazine, I think called Bijou, which Ted Sennett was the publisher of, and he loved Long Goodbye. I mean, that was the film. That's my favorite film ever, you know, from him. He just loved it, and he loved the ending, and he said, Altman considered me a jazz actor. I could just, you know, do the improvising and all my body movements and all that stuff. And you'll like this. We went to Altman had a little studio, and we went to his see a screening of Three Women. I had met Altman once before, but I met him, and that was a really a better way, just among a few people, including Elliot Gould. And what a nice guy Robert Altman was. Yeah. So you'll be happy to
absolutely.
Know.
Absolutely. Well, okay, so the question is, you know, we were talking about what a cult movie is, but you know, this is something that always comes up at ISF, because they always say, well, what's strange? Well, that's not strange, but it is strange to someone. And you're right that a cult, you know, a movie has a small amount of followers that are, I guess, you know, rabid about it would be how I would say. But cult has to do with, you know, the reaction that it didn't do well at the box office, or that it's just completely strange, or all these elements. And when you look at a movie to include in your series of books, what elements were you looking at to consider it a cult?
Well, I did three books, I told you, and this you'll find a little amusing is, I said that before, one book came out 2 years later and one book came out 5 years later. And in each intro, I would have to say what my definition of cult movies was. And I would do the book. And my books, I will say with humility, got wonderful reviews. But there always can be people complaining about my definition of cult movies. They were always disagreeing. So I had three introductions I did. So after 2 years of people complaining, then I got to do another introduction with maybe a slightly different definition, and then people complained more, and then 5 years later I had a third. So my definition to you would probably be different tomorrow than it was yesterday. So it kept changing.
Yeah, that's absolutely true, because it always changes.
Yeah, but let me say this. You know, people used to think of cult movies as people like, you know, five nerds would get together and go to a basement in a church, and they'd watch a movie and that nobody else cares about and heard about, and they'd love that movie, and that would be, you know, the films would be so obscure that they would be called cult movies. But I never thought that was totally the case, because even though those were cult movies, there are also films like Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, which came out in 1919, 1920, and played 7 years in a row in one theater in France. And that was always called a cult movie. So was Beat the Devil and Casablanca, you know, the Bogart films, which were shown at the Brattle Theater in festivals in Cambridge. They became known as, in the lingo, as cult movies. We were called that. All About Eve, we would hear about that as cult movies because people were reciting the dialogue. So I was already thinking that these films that kept being in the conversation when people had talked about all these movies in history, that, you know, all these thousands and thousands of movies, only certain amount of films kept being in the conversation. So I was already thinking other films were cult movies that were, you know, were being kept alive by a certain segment of the audience. And if you see when I did my cult movie books, that's when the heyday of the midnight movies started. That's when Rocky Horror mm-hmm. Picture Show and Eraserhead and The Harder They Come and El Topo and Night of the Living Dead were all playing the midnight circuit. And they all had different kinds of fan bases. But the main thing I was realizing, and you realize this too, and everybody, Rocky Horror Picture Show was making a fortune. And it was still being referred to as a cult movie. It wasn't a midnight movie. It was a cult movie because of the fans. And so I deliberately expanded the definition of cult movies, what they would be. And in my three intros, which are long intros, I have long definitions of cult movies, which I won't get into. But basically, it was people taking certain films to heart, feeling that they had to see, and feeling that the director or the screenwriter or the actors were talking directly to them. How did they know that I liked this particular thing or felt this way about a certain theme or whatever? How did they know? And then you had to see that film over and over again, no matter where it was playing. And literally people people would tell me, you know, they read my chapter on a certain film and cult movies, and they would go, they would drive to a different state to see a movie that they really wanted to see, and they see it over and over again. But the key thing besides it all, they had to share these movies. They couldn't keep it to themselves. They would, you know, say what I mentioned before, you got to see this movie that I love, and they might get a response. I already saw that. I didn't know anybody else liked it. And they would spread and spread again. And at that time, there were, before there was internet and all that stuff there, the people would read my Little Shop of Horrors essay. This is one thing that I remember distinctly, as some person saying, Little Shop of Horrors, I live in Pennsylvania. I get a lot of mail. And this person wrote, I live in Pennsylvania. I had no idea anybody else in America ever heard of Little Shop of Horrors. And like Little Shop of Horrors. So people were unaware that there were cults forming all around the country about certain films, and it was the same films over and over again that people were responding to. And so this all got into my thinking. You know, the films have to be somewhat different. They're not mainstream films. And years later, they aren't geared for the mainstream audience. They're, you know, they're geared. People who see them are a smaller group, but are obsessive about them, and, you know, take the films to heart, and have a fiery passion, as I always describe it, for these films. And that's pretty much what my cult movie definition is. People can like the movies. They can like the stars, like James Dean, Marilyn Monroe. You know, people, the actors and the actresses who have cults, and a lot of the horror movie actors and actresses, of course, have their own cults. So there are a lot of titles. People keep asking me to write cult movies for, and I say if I started now, including all the cult movies that came after 1988, that I'd have to do about 15 books. There's just so many that have happened. The big difference, Carl and Rachel, is when I wrote these books, nobody making movies at the time wanted to make a cult movie, because that meant they weren't going to have a mass appeal. And nowadays, especially with all the film festivals, the big thing that everybody, especially independent filmmakers, want is word of mouth, which is a staple of cult movies. So everybody wants to have their movie be a cult movie, and people be talking about it and spreading the word about how good or how different or how interesting or how violent or how great the special effects are, or how great the music is, and how novel the themes are, and that kind of thing. And that's how cult movies are not a dime a dozen now, but they're a lot more now than there used to be.
Oh, absolutely.
Well, yeah.
Go ahead, Rach.
Oh, I was just going to say, really, with the rise of indie making, just period. I can't say just filmmaking. I mean, there's indie game making, there's indie movie making, there's indie just about everything. And really, word of mouth is one of the best advertisement tactics in the world. And I think that's why there are more cult movies now. And I agree with you on that. It is the rise of people independently trying to create stuff, because they realize that you don't have to have the big Hollywood, you know, bang up bonus to actually have a good piece of material. So, yeah.
Well,
word
of mouth, it's free publicity, and it's authentic. It's not coming from the studios and so that's why we believe it. And that's why I told you before, Carl, that, you know, when I write down the titles of the films people recommend to me, because I believe that, you know, that they are genuinely enthusiastic about them. So
I just
why not
go
give them
on
a look
and say that I am not personally recommending Basketball to you, but if that is a movie, okay,
let me cross it off the list quickly. Yeah.
But it is a cult movie, and if that's something you're into, you may want to give it another watch, just a quick rewatch, just to see,
yeah.
Because they do actually, you know, they come up with legitimate rules for a new game. It's just raucous and bawdy. So.
It wasn't to say that's the worst movie I ever saw. I just, could have been, it could have been better because there was actually talent behind that movie. So the people who made it are talented people, but I think it was a fun idea and I can't believe they made it. And then but I'll give it another look. I took out my pencil with an eraser, and I've not gotten rid of the line that went through the title.
But to be honest, that's what we do with these podcasts. Because over the years, I've gotten to know directors and actors and such. Like we just had John Amplis on for Halloween. We've done. People like Rob Schmidt, who did Wrong Turn, and a number of people that are so, you know, the one thing about filmmakers who aren't, you know, the big Spielbergs and that, they have a passion for what they do. And it's that passion, I think, that translates to someone who feels it as a viewer, and then that becomes their movie, and they want to pass that on. And of course, with a film group like ISF, you know, we have so many people out there passionate about film. And so it's a wonderful thing, I think, to the one good thing about social media is that you get these communities that really are passionate about the subject. And you know, if we can filmmakers and first-time filmmakers and that, and really put a spotlight on them, you know, we can help them in terms like that as word of mouth. So that's one of the reasons I really started this and partnered with this group. So, you know, maybe I'm sort of like passing the torch and trying to do the same thing you are in a different way.
Well, that's exactly what you said there, Carl, is exactly what I did because I was, you know, at the time I did all those early books particularly, I was just so passionate about the subject, and I think it was very apparent in my writing. I never told people not to see a movie that I didn't like.
Mm-hmm.
I always encouraged them to see it anyway, because I would say, you know, maybe, especially when I did that book, Guide for the Film Fanatic, which I wrote about 1,600-something films. And, of course, I didn't like them all. But I said in the intro that, you know, anything in this book is worth seeing. And I want you to see it, and I encourage you to see it, and I have enthusiasm for you seeing it. And that's the whole goal of all my writing has always been to get people to see movies, not to discourage them. And it always really bothers me when people say, should I skip this movie or not? And I say, I don't want to say ever to skip a movie. I can say I like this film better than another film, and this film's more interesting, but telling somebody to skip a movie always rubs me the wrong way. So I think I feel very similar to you about with my books, and you feel the same way about your show.
Now, yeah, it's funny because that's one of the things that I've noticed about your writing, whether it be the sports writing, whether it be the film writing, is that there's a real passion about the subject.
Yeah.
And that's what comes through.
Yeah, my books were answers to people who wrote snobby books that for other critics. My books were always written with the reader in mind, and the readers were critics included, I hope, but for the general moviegoer who's heart beat extra fast when they went into a movie theater and started watching a movie on TV. You know, because I experienced all that since I was a little kid. My love for baseball and music and movies and even television is I have so much appreciation for those the sports and the music and the movies and the TV that I want to express that. You know, I'm thankful for what they gave me during my childhood and beyond, because in college days and 20s, I just saw so many movies, and I'm grateful. So I think that came across in my writing.
Yeah. So anyway, one of the things I did want to mention, and I mentioned this briefly, is that
I'm losing you.
Yeah, I think we lost Carl.
We lost Carl. You should be calling back in here in just a moment. I do apologize for that.
That is okay. I am still here, guys.
I'm here. You hear me?
Well, yes, I can hear you. Yeah. Can you hear me?
Yeah. So how you been?
Oh, quite well, quite well.
Good.
I have been fascinated listening to you. You can ask either of the guys. I've never been quiet for that long in my life. So.
I can verify that.
It's absolutely amazing to hear you talk about your process, because you don't even have to tell people that you're passionate about what you've done and what you're doing for it to just, like, shine through. And I don't even know. I'm just kind of in awe right now, because I always wanted to be a writer. I never was, but so it's really amazing to hear, like, where you started this and why you started this, and it was all just because you wanted to meet somebody.
Yeah, that was the baseball. But I love movies so much, and I've done so many interviews with people, and I've done so many. I don't know if I'm retired or not. I can't tell ever, but locally I'm in Sag Harbor, Long Island, and there are local papers out here, newspapers and magazines, and I've been doing interviews for 7, 8, 9, 10 years for free. You know, just to, although I'm a sports writer now, I still like to keep my foot in the movie game and the business. So I like to do a lot of interviews, and I interview a lot of people probably you'd like who are not the biggest stars in the world. I do some of those, but very rarely. I do mostly independent filmmakers or people, foreign filmmakers, who are just trying to get their films known. And
now we've recently opened up our ISF, our Independently Strange Films group on Facebook. Very recently opened it up to our independent creators being able to show some of their work on the page, which has actually I've been really impressed by a lot of the work I've seen. I mean, we're getting a lot of short films. We're getting a lot of, like, musical scores that people have done. And it's really fantastic because, again, it's all this, like, indie cult kind of stuff. It's like, oh, you know, our band sounds like these guys and these guys and these guys, but if you're not part of that scene, it wouldn't make any sense to you. But if you are, you're like, oh my God, these guys are going to be amazing. And that's kind of what I'm liking about you is you take an open approach to everything.
Well, there's
I'm back.
Talent.
Oh,
I got
rid of
it.
Sorry. Who's this interrupting? Hi, Carl.
So thank
well,
you, Rachel.
Well.
So anyway, before I was raptured, I was going to say for everyone to follow your page and that, because you come up with some wonderful questions that basically choices between one or two artists or one or two movies and things like that. And that's how we really connected, because I think they're fascinating. So I was wondering if you had a question for Rachel or us.
Well, you know, all the people who follow all my threads, they're probably taking their pens out right now, because there will be these will be some of the things that I might post in the future. So they want to, you know, be all ready for these. But I just do simple things. One of them that I, in fact, already did, and let's get your reply. Who's the better Dracula, Bela Lugosi or Christopher Lee? So did you, I don't know if you saw that one, but that got a lot of response, and it was almost divided in half.
Okay.
We'll let Rachel
repeat the question really quick. I'm so sorry.
The better Dracula challenge, Bela Lugosi or Christopher Lee?
Well, I mean, Bela Lugosi's dead. Bauhaus taught me that, but...
they're both dead.
Right.
Yeah, they're both dead now.
I'm just going to have to say, I told this story a while back about me having all of the horror movie greats in my room. I'm going to have to say Lugosi.
Well, I agree. What about Carl? What do you think?
I have to be the other person in the room and say Christopher Lee. Now, that's nothing to
dissenter
against Lugosi. Okay, but to be honest, I'll explain this. Okay, so Chiller's Theater was on Pittsburgh, and you see Frankenstein and all the universals, right? And then suddenly, there was Christopher Lee, who to me was scarier, and to be honest, I'm going into puberty at that point, and I'm seeing heaving bosoms. So I'm okay with that.
So you're liking the Christopher Lee movie. Well, that's the movies more. But what about the
movies,
the Dracula?
But the one thing that Christopher Lee had over Lugosi was he was more feral.
Mm-hmm.
He was a lot scarier. And also the sense of the blood coming down his face, you know, from the fangs and so on and so forth. And that, of course, is you know, the code was dissipating, and they could do things like that more so than in the 30s. So, to me, it was scarier, and he was scarier. So I'd have to go with Lee, and that is nothing against Lugosi, because I love Lugosi too.
Rachel, Carl doesn't like Bela Lugosi. So what do you think?
Well, what I have to say about that,
I'm joking,
is,
Carl. I hope you know I'm joking.
honestly, I read the book, and as far as the two, as far as like a
great
feral,
book,
crazy, beautiful actor, yeah, Lee did way better. But if you're trying to go for the real Dracula here, he was like a super gentleman, okay? He was very regal. He was very pristine. He was nothing but manners. I get more of that grace from Lugosi than I did from Lee. And that's where it really got me.
You got to remember, Lugosi was a sex symbol after that movie. He was thought of as a romantic guy. So
I mean, I'm not going to kick him out of the coffin or anything, but.
No. What about Max Schreck, Nosferatu? That's the great look, the great looking vampire, Nosferatu, the Murnau.
Yeah.
The bald head and the.
That one was scary for me. That freaked me out.
Yeah.
Oh, that is freaky. Even today, you see that.
Yeah, nobody knows what happened to the actor. That's the other thing. They think he might have actually been a vampire. So.
Well, of course, they did a film about that with Defoe.
That's a creepy movie, too. That whole thing was creepy. They might have actually hired an actor who was the vampire to play the vampire. Very creepy.
Well, I won't get into the whole story here, but some people did some genealogy a long time ago in my family, and I am very distantly but directly related to Vlad Tepes. So Vlad.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, as in so many greats, like grandfather, apparently. So I am technically descended from the original vampire family. If you guys ever need to say, you know, a real life vampire, here you go.
Okay. Okay.
That is something to brag about.
I didn't hire her because of that fact. Okay. I'm just saying.
You did not know that until just now.
No, I didn't. I didn't. Not at all.
Do you want another one?
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely.
All right. So here, the better thing, the better the thing challenge. So, The Thing from Another World from 1951, directed by Christian Nyby, but probably by Howard Hawks, or John Carpenter's The Thing. Which do you prefer?
Okay, I'll go first. I think Carpenter's film is a masterpiece. And it has one of the great WTF moments ever, when that head comes off and the spider legs come on. It's a brilliant film. But honestly, I prefer the 50s version. The reason I prefer the 50s version, in a lot of ways, is the dialogue. And the way that Nyby / Hawks, you know, uses that to propel the story around, even though Carpenter's version is more akin to the original story by Jack Finney.
Wait. Original story is John Campbell. Jack Finney's Invasion of the Body Snatchers. The guy.
Oh, okay. Sorry. Wrong one.
Okay.
But I grew up watching The Thing from Another World. I don't know how many times I saw that on Chiller Theater, and I was just thrilled by it. You know, being a 6, 7,
yeah,
8-year-old kid. And so that to me, I think it has to do with the time that I saw it and how much I loved it at that time. But I have a great love of that film. So I'd have to go with The Thing from Another Planet.
I have a great appreciation for what you just said, because I'm not a fan of the Carpenter film. I'm a fan of the first film, but I know almost everybody loves the Carpenter film. So for you to be able to say you love the Carpenter film but still like the first one better, I appreciate that. And Rachel, what do you think?
Wow. Okay, so
It's a tough one.
I'm not being a lemming here, okay, but I'm about to send the guys on my end a picture of one of my shelves right now. I do love the John Carpenter The Thing, and the reason I'm sending them a picture of my shelf is because it's got my my figurine of The Thing on it. So yes, I love John Carpenter's The Thing, but if it's between the two, I'm gonna have to go with the original, and here is why. If you speak Norwegian, the very first conversation in the John Carpenter movie spells everything out for you. Literally, when the two scientists are talking and they're speaking in a foreign language, if you translate it directly, apparently, it tells you the whole fucking plot of the movie. And I'm sorry, but I can't hang with that. So I've got to go with the original here, because I do love the movie in and of itself, but I hate the fact that I know that, and I'm never going to be able to unsee or unhear that fact. Yeah.
That's right, Carl. All of us who know Norwegian, you know, we just got up and walked out of the theater as soon as we heard that opening.
You know, I did forget that you told us about that the other day. For those of you that don't know, we have a half Norwegian man here with us.
Will the other half appear sometime?
Like
no. Well, I'll tell you. Do you want to hear my objections to the second to John Carpenter's
Absolutely.
The Thing?
Yes, please.
Absolutely.
Yes. You know, I'm gonna post that challenge soon, so we'll get all kinds of reactions, because I have found that when I ask not just horror movie fans, but when I ask movie directors and writers, you know, what are the horror films that influence you? Almost all the young people either pick The Shining or The Thing. And it's like they never saw a movie going back prior to that, and that's that after that. So I get frustrated because they don't really know previous movies, including the original The Thing. My objection to The Thing, I do appreciate that John Carpenter did go back to the John Campbell, I think it's like a story from 1938. I don't know that off the top of my head. I looked it up. And it had to do with all kinds of creatures like Carpenter has in The Thing, but it also had to do with the thing from outer space being able to inhabit the different individuals at the Arctic station. And what I had problem with in the Carpenter film is this is a film where people's identities are taken, which is a major theme in the majority of horror movies. But we don't really know who these characters are. We don't really feel badly about them losing their identities because we never get to know them well enough. He casts people who we kind of, you know, Wilford Brimley and stuff, we automatically kind of know who they are, but we never really get to know them. So when they get their identity taken, like Dana Winter, we mentioned Invasion of the Body Snatchers, when Kevin McCarthy kisses her and realizes she fell asleep and has been taken over and her identity is gone. Say, you know, you just moan. We don't really care about any of these people. So it becomes, particularly toward the end, just one amazing but annoying to me special effects thing after another, and we never, I don't care about any of the people except for, you know, Kurt Russell, but all the other people.
I think you just perfectly described every Wes Craven movie to me ever. I mean,
well, sometimes filmmakers will actually do that on purpose. Say, I have to kill this person off, and I'm going to do it in a gruesome way. Now, my choice is, do I make people like this person, or do I not really say who they are so when they kill, they don't really get mad at me for being so cruel to these characters? Because I always have my main problem with a lot of horror movies is the cruelty toward characters we like that the filmmakers choose to do, like in films like Wolf Creek and whatever. They have any kind of, and kill the characters in any way they want, but they decide, let's do it the most gruesome way possible, you know, that kind of stuff. Just really mean. There's a meanness to a lot of films. And I think the... Well, as I said, it's the thing really bothers me in terms of just, as I said, the special effects are amazing, and he goes back to the original story, which is good that we have one film that does that. I think the one that came after that with Mary Elizabeth Winstead, that did it out a little bit too, but he was the first to do it. But as I said, I think his whole excitement came from, let's do these amazing special effects, which he did. They're incredible, and they're scary and whatever, and it's really gruesome. But I wish maybe if expand the film 15 more minutes, you know, even like Alien, we knew all those characters by the time they were killed, right? In the original Alien, we liked all those characters and whatever, and then they start getting killed. We knew who they were, so it really bothered us. So it didn't really bother me when any of these people were killed in The Thing. If the characters had been killed in the original Thing, that would have been upsetting.
Yeah.
So
yeah, and we you got, get to know the to know characters them. In the original, and I think you hit upon it exactly. you know, because I love those characters. Even the scientist, who turns out to be somewhat of a jerk, but you know,
the original thing just set up a lot of things that would happen in future science fiction movies regarding the role of the military and the role of the scientist, how we're supposed to perceive them in science fiction movies. Do we go along with scientists, or are they too crazed, or should we, because they're intelligent men, should we believe them, or should we go along with military leaders who, you know, what they are is generals and they want to fire guns. Who should we believe? Which side are we on? And that's one of the choices you have to make watching the thing and then future movies. What side should we be on? Should we be on the scientists who generally are a little crazy in all the movies, or so kindly that they want to make friends with aliens, or should we go with the military who shoot first and ask questions later kind of thing, and may result in an intergalactic war because they were too quick on the trigger?
I completely agree there.
So that's the thing is, besides being just a really fun movie and scary, you know, the scene where you open the door and James Arness is standing right against the door and jumps out, that's really one of the great shock moments in science fiction movies. But it set the precedent for a lot of future movies on how we view aliens, how we view military, how we view scientists, and how we view the heroes. What are the heroes in our films, like Kenneth Tobey and that, who doesn't know anything about science, but he knows how to give orders, and he follows the leads, but advice of people, but always makes his own decisions, always going forward, always going for the truth, and always getting the girl.
Yeah.
Because
yeah,
of that.
That's part of it too, of course. well, you know, I don't want to have you on too much in that thing and overstay your welcome, but Danny, I this has been a wonderful hour. You're more than welcome to come anytime back. So before we go into what we like to call housekeeping, just remind us of the books that are out there and what's available and if you have anything else planned, or you're just sitting back and having a good time. But just tell us
about
there's
the books. There's a pandemic going on, so I guess I'm sitting back. I think all my writing is basically on hold, which is part of the reason I've been doing all these fun challenges that I'm posting on Facebook. So I invite anybody to come on there. Most of my books are, I don't know which, all of them, but all my movie books are out of print. If you invited me on next year, it would be 40 years for cult movies. It was in print for many years, as was Close-Ups, but they're out of print now. But, of course, you can find them on Amazon and use bookstores and find them, you know, buy whatever the cheapest ones you can find. But I guess what
Do
I can recommend...
Do you know where you can get your books? Because I personally know where you can get, like, all of Danny Perry's books.
On your shelf?
Most of them are not more than $4.99, and you can get them on Amazon. There's actually a couple of them that you can get for free right now in the cult movies arena, and they are for the Amazon Kindle platform. And I think a few of the copies that you pay for, you can actually get on multiple different e-readers. So,
okay, well, that is the one thing I will push. Thank you for bringing that up, Rachel. I do have there are actually four e-books that are put out by Workman Publishing, W-R-K-M-A-N, one word, Workman Publishing. There are three books. They're all connected to my cult movie. So there's a free one, which is Cult Science Fiction, and that's free. And I don't know how many titles are in there. I don't know if it's a full book. The other three are three, you know, I guess whatever price you said, I have no idea because I don't have to read those books. But they're e-books, and there's an horror movie book. There's an e-midnight movie book and an e-crime movies. So there are three, and the horror movie and the science fiction are perfect for your audience. So I hope people will look. Just keep in mind that I wrote them a long time ago, and so when certain films you want to read about aren't in there, that's what the reason they're not in there, because they're old books. But I am proud of saying that I think the essays hold up. I think, you know, when I do read anything again because I forget what a film is about or something and I'll read my essay, I sort of agree with almost everything I wrote and I don't really feel dated. I mean, there are people I talk about who have died since I wrote those books. That's many years ago, who were alive at the time. But my discussions on the films, I think people will still find interesting, which is why Workman Publishing put out these e-books, because they didn't feel they were dated. So I hope people check it out.
Absolutely. And the one thing I would say to our listeners and to our members at ISF is that it's important to look at the past and see where things came from. And one thing I can say about Danny's writing is that of the three books I have, which is Cult Movies 1, 2, and 3, they'll get you interested in films you may not have heard of or you think are too old or whatever the case would be. And I think that's an important thing, that as an older generation, it's our it's one of our things that we should do, is to you know, pass on the knowledge and get people interested in some of the older films. And so we try to do that also at ISF. And that's something I think is very important to do. Danny, it has been an absolute pleasure to have you on.
Thank you.
We have a caller. Okay, we have a caller.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
I just put him in the system. I should be right there.
Hello, caller.
Hello?
Hey, Derek, wow. How are you?
Yeah, it's Derek Ferguson.
Yeah, how are you? Good to hear you.
Fine. How you doing? Yeah, my phone's been acting wonky all day long, and I was trying to call in, so I said, you know what? Let me just let him know over the good old Facebook I'm trying to call in.
There we go. I actually got raptured. So, yeah, there's something wonky with the connection a little bit.
I'm
so, Derek, you have a question for Danny?
Connection problems.
Actually, it's not so much a question as I just want to give Mr. Perry a profound thank you. Because
profound.
I've been a fan of
your
book.
You're welcome, but what for?
I've been a fan of your book. I've been a fan of your book since the 80s. As a matter of fact, I had to buy multiple copies of the first one because I read it so much, pages started falling out. I fancy myself to be a bit of a movie reviewer myself. And much of the style I took of my reviewing movies and how I approach movies, I freely admit I stole from you, because your style of writing was just so conversational. It made me feel like I was sitting down next to a long-lost friend and just talking about movies for hours. That's always the feeling I get from reading your books. That's still the impression that I get from reading your books. So... thank you.
Well,
I mean, there's a lot of good movies I would have never seen if it hadn't been for you. And any little success I have as a movie reviewer, I owe to you and to Roger Ebert, who you guys are like you're the pinnacle as far as I'm concerned when it comes to movie reviewing.
Well, let me say what I tell people every once in a while when they give me as nice a compliment as you do. I always say that I'm happy, very gratified that the people who were influenced by my books are good people, and they went on to do good things. So that's what I'm always proud of, that I had an impact on people who are people who have positive attitudes about movies and the same love of movies that I do, and in your case went on to do some writing. So I'm very happy, and thanks so much for calling. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you, Derek. I'm so happy right now.
Well, I'm glad I could make you happy.
Sorry, that was not so sweet. I got
just to give Derek a little bit of props. Derek is a black pulp writer, and he is a wonderful writer, good friend. He's been on the podcast a number of times, and we're going to get you back on in February. I have a thought. I'll be in contact. But it's really good that you called, Derek. I really appreciate it very much.
Oh, absolutely. Like I said, you know, Mr. Peary, he's been, you know, I could not let him get away without thanking him, you know, for the way he's enriched my life and my career through his reviews.
Oh, good. Good. See, Danny, you have a positive impact. And that's one thing that we try to say. Anyone that makes a film, anyone that writes about film, anyone that acts in film, it's a wonderful thing that you've done. Seriously.
Well,
I am pretty sure that the whole of the internet and broadcast world listening to this ending of our segment just got enriched. That was fucking beautiful, guys. I'm so sorry.
Well, it's humble and gratifying to be remembered. So as I said, these books are not, you know, I didn't do them a couple of years ago. I did them many years ago. So it's really nice that people still remember them. And as I said, I mean, I'm truthful on that. It's the people who tell me they've been impacted in general, almost to, you know, 100%, they've been really good people and have gone on to do really good things. So I have I'm 10 for 10 in batting on that so far. So very pleased.
If I could throw just one more thing in. Hello?
Go ahead.
Yeah, if I could throw just one more thing in. I think
don't change your mind. Don't change your mind, okay?
No. I think that the charm and the appeal of your books after all this time, you know, the cult movie books, is that you did write movie reviews just for the average Joe and Jane punch clock just going to the movies on Fridays and Saturdays. You weren't writing for movie critics or, you know, the Cannes Film Festival or, you know, the highfalutin, you know, literati. You were just writing for regular people who just wanted to see a good movie. And that comes across in your writing. And I think that that's why people are still reading them now and why they still have that charm and that appeal. Because I read your reviews now and they're still as entertaining as they was when I read them back in the 1980s. And that's it. Now I'm going to shut up.
That gives a perfect reason why I stopped writing. I quit while I was ahead, right?
No, because I'll tell you something.
No.
Hold on, Derek.
About?
I'll tell you something. Your passion that you have for films also goes to your sports books. So let me tell you something. We started out with the sports books for 10 minutes. For those people that love the cult movie books, read Danny Perry's sports books. It's the same thing. It's only about baseball, but the passion and the sense of writing for the fans is there in those books too. So I just wanted to make that point.
Well, thank you very much. This is very humbling, but and as I said, very gratifying. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr.
Very welcome.
Perry.
And as I said, you're always welcome back anytime. Anytime.
Okay,
if you want to do a whole show of your questions during quarantine, let me know. We'll do it. Not a problem.
No. I'll accumulate them. But I will be continuing to put up things on Facebook, my challenges on Facebook. So just to get – they're all to get – you know, I don't care what people say. It's just to get people to respond. And especially during the pandemic, people, you know, gives them a little escapism. So I'll keep posting these challenges and, you know, keep, you know, you yourself gave me a few titles that I hadn't heard of. So thank you. So keep contributing.
Oh, I will. There's no doubt about it. It's one of the most entertaining spots on Facebook for me. So absolutely.
That's great. Okay.
So anyway, we're going to go into a little bit of housekeeping now. So on Friday, Ad Ferenz and the Cathode Ray Mission are going to be going through the films of Paul Thomas Anderson. And then starting next week is the week before Christmas. Oh, my goodness gracious. So we're going to have a whole week of shows. And starting on Tuesday, filmmaker Joe Bedard, and by the way, Danny, there's a film that Joe did called Sister Tempest. It just came out this year.
Mm-hmm.
You should probably check it out. Seriously.
Okay, I'm going to put it over the other title
that
you mentioned earlier.
Get that little pencil out with the eraser.
Yeah, Joe is a good friend of the podcast and been on a number of times. And Joe and I are doing a watch, commentary watch on Tuesday the 15th on three television segments. And the one he picked is ADBC, which is a absolutely terrible musical version of Christmas. That sounds like a bad Elton John. It's wonderful. And also we'll be doing one of the ones we'll be doing is a Christmas special. I'm not going to say what it is, but the Christmas special was a cross-dressing cockroach, and that's all I'll say at this point. But we're going to do that on
Hasn't that been
on
done
Wednesday
already?
That... Yeah, it has been done actually. And then on Wednesday, Rachel, you have a show that we have on Wednesday the 16th. So why don't you tell us about that show? Because that's going to be your first show.
Yes, my debut premiere podcast, Down the Rabbit Hole, will be happening on Wednesday the 16th. We are going to be doing the anti-Christmas music, Christmas music spectacular. A lot of different but Christmas-themed songs for those of us tired of everything that's been on the radio since the evening of Thanksgiving. And that's about it as far as I can remember.
Yeah, that's what we're going to do on Wednesday. On Thursday of that week, I know that we will have another watch, which may or may not be either One Magic Christmas or perhaps Pottersville. We have not decided exactly which one that will be. And then on Friday, Adam, which is a week from this Friday, Adam will be doing his Christmas program, which will be about our favorite TV specials and Christmas movies and things like that. So we'll be doing that. But we're all getting ready for Christmas. And then we're going to take a break after Christmas. And then in January, I can tell you that on January 5th, when we return with the ISF podcast after Christmas break, we will have Jeff Lieberman on. Jeff is the director who did Squirm and Blue Sunshine, Remote Control, a number of films, Satan's Little Helper. Jeff is a really good filmmaker and good friend. I've done a podcast with him before. And then Also during January, we will be scheduling cult movie director Jackie Kong, one of the few female directors out there. And we'll get her view on.
Yay.
Yep. And then, and of course, that would be Blood Diner and The Bean and Night Patrol are the three films that she did. We have a lot of other people on in the works. And we're also going to be able to get people in from outside the country. So we now have that ability. So we have people lined up that I've got a schedule for both January and February from, you know, Turkey and Australia and things like that. So that's going to work out well, too. We now are able to do that. So we're growing, and we really appreciate you listening to us and ISF. And again, Danny, it has been an absolute pleasure to have you on.
Thank you so much. That again, Rachel.
Oh, I said super awesome.
Oh, that one word or two?
It depends on how.
I think with her, it's one word.
One word.
I can say that one word.
Well, it was really a pleasure, and it's neat to be on to you as you expand your shows and everything and grow. So I was there toward the beginning, so it's really good.
Well, thank you very, very much, Danny. And as I said, you're welcome back anytime if you want to do a show on your questions or whatever you want to do. Just let me know.
Just keep me in mind. Okay.
I will.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, folks, for listening. We will see you on Friday with Adam Ferenz and the Cathode Ray Mission and Paul Thomas Anderson. So thank you very much for listening, folks. And let's all say good night.
Good night.